Hello, everyone. This is episode 53 of the iPhone Podcast. For show notes and to send us feedback, please visit theiphonepodcast.com. I'm your host, Gary Ng, and I'm here alongside Justin Louie, and we have a pretty cool show coming up for you. How you doing? How you doing, Justin?
I'm very good. I guess I'll start by saying I kind of screwed up last week. Normally, when we do the podcast, our goal is to kind of the week before deal with the rumors of the new event and kind of make our predictions, and then the next week we cover it. And last week we sort of just glossed over it because I was pretty sure this event maybe wasn't even going to happen. The rumors were weird. Jim Dalrymple and some of those people I had mentioned hadn't confirmed it, and then right after we recorded, it got confirmed, and here we are. So this week we'll just cover it, but we didn't have our normal preview show because I was skeptical that this event would happen, and sure enough it happened, and there's some major news out of it, so let's get to it.
All right. So today, as everyone knows, Apple had a special event to announce the new smaller iPad along with a whole bunch of other goodies. So let's get right to it. Right away, this time the event took place at the California Theater in San Jose. This is a venue where Apple had done a couple other introductions. Say back in 2004 and 2005, Steve Jobs had announced a couple iPods there, specifically the U2 Special Edition iPod and also the new iPod video. But anyways, Tim Cook was on stage, and basically the mantra of the kind of the press invite was, "We've got a little more to show you." So, I mean, obviously, people are going to read into that line. I guess the little part would emphasize, you know, possibly the iPad mini. But, of course, Tim Cook, right away, this is not new to us, went into the numbers. Basically, he mentioned that there were 5 million iPhones sold. This is the iPhone 5. And he played an iPhone 5 launch video, which Apple seems to really enjoy nowadays. Kind of showing these launches. Also mentioned that there were 3 million new iPods sold. This included, I guess, the iPod Touch and the new iPod Nano. Also, he mentioned that there are now 200 million devices running iOS 6. He called it one of the fastest adoptions of any mobile operating system. There are now 125 million documents in the cloud. As for iMessage, he said last year there were 300 billion iMessages sent, roughly 28,000 per second. When it came to Game Center, he said there are now 160 million Game Center accounts. As for shared photo stream, there are now 70 million photos have been shared. The App Store has 700,000 apps, 275,000 specific iPad apps. Apps downloaded, 35 billion apps downloaded to date, and $6.5 billion paid to developers. So what did you get out of those numbers?
Well, as we've said before, we can basically count on Tim Cook doing this every time. We're only about a month from the last event, so there wasn't anything too earth-shattering. A few things kind of stuck out to me when I was watching it. The 5 million iPhones in the first weekend, that was the number that was already reported, so there's no update there. I find that a little curious, but they do have an earnings call coming up fairly shortly, so maybe they want to save that for that. The video was cool, and I thought the thing that, again, stuck out of my mind a little bit with the video was Samsung is basically on a daily basis running commercials, making fun of people standing in line, and that didn't make Apple shy away from that. They were quite happy to say, well, you're making fun of one of our strongest things. People love these products. They're in line. They're happy. That's the funny thing about that Samsung commercial. I see what they're going for, but at the same time, I think they're reversely sort of putting it back in people's mind that, hey, nobody's lining up for these Samsung devices. So I thought that was a little bit interesting. The 3 million iPods sold is pretty remarkable considering you've barely been able to get them in stores. So that's basically they pre-ordered that much. 200 million iOS devices upgraded already in just a month. And then, of course, $6.5 billion paid to developers jumped out at me, too. That's why Apple's going to continue to be leading the way in software, because Google just is not paying that kind of money to developers. So despite some VCs and some people over the years saying that very shortly you would see developers flocking to Android, that just hasn't been the case. Most times you still see a lot of exclusive content that's iOS only. And when you do see Instagrams and Tumblr and these different big operations, the Android app always seems like to be the second, playing second fiddle. It's always updated later, always lags behind in features. So that's a good thing for Apple right there.
Yeah, and right away there was also another minor update. He talked about iBooks. He said that there's been about 1.5 million books downloaded. 1.5 million books available, and 400 million books have been downloaded, which is, you know, not bad, but it could definitely be a lot better. And that basically was a segue into his announcement of a new version of iBooks, iBooks 3, which actually was just released shortly this evening. It includes improved iCloud support and new continuous scrolling. Have you had a chance to check out the new iBooks yet?
I just looked at it really quickly. I like the fact that you can now see all the books you've purchased, and it almost works like iTunes Match, where everything's just sitting there and then you can download it. As far as continuous scrolling going, obviously some people ask for that. The opposite. A lot of reading apps used to only have that. I like the page flip myself, so that's not a big deal, but the iBooks is certainly probably Apple's weakest link when it comes to their whole ecosystem, but I thought 1.5 million books being available and 400 million downloads isn't bad. It, for something that's sort of being touted as Apple's big disaster area, an area they're really struggling in, those are pretty good numbers. I'm sure most companies would like to be selling 400 million or having 400 million downloads of a failure. So I think it's an area that Apple needs to improve on, but they're slowly but surely getting there, and I like the product.
Yeah, it's good for people who want to read on their iOS devices. Next up here, moving on, there was a Mac update. Now, let's just talk a little bit prior to this event. There were rumors that Apple was going to update their iMac and their Mac Mini, along with continuous rumors of a 13-inch MacBook Pro with a Retina display that was coming out. So everyone had this in mind. Everyone was thinking about this when Tim started talking about the Macs. So going on to the Mac update, he said that Macs had outgrew the PC market 7 times. They've outgrown the PC market 6 years in a row now. Apple, they are the number one notebook maker in the U.S., and they are the number one desktop maker in the U.S. as well, which is, when you think about it, it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that gets lost when you look at the overall market share, because, of course, PCs are all the manufacturers together, and you always see that Apple's at 5 or 10 or 12%, but you forget in that area, because they're the only one making that, that's the reason for the overall number, but they're constantly either number one or very close to it in both things. So I wasn't at all surprised to hear that they're the number one manufacturer of notebooks and desktops. So I think we had heard that before, but he did bring it out again.
Okay, so after Tim, you know, talked about the numbers, he introduces Phil Schiller on stage, and Was it Phil or Tim that did the Mac numbers?
He did the I don't remember.
I think Tim did it, right?
I think they both sort of did. I think Tim did the basic numbers, and then Phil Schiller came out, reiterated where they are, and then started introducing, said he had new stuff to show us.
Yeah, I'm surprised that we both don't remember, since this only happened like less than 12 hours ago. But what was also really interesting today that we should bring up was, this was early this morning, Apple announced on their website that they were going to live stream the event, which is something that they haven't done for at least 2 years. So instead of just following all these live blogs of various media outlets that were there, people managed to watch a live stream on any iOS device or using Safari, which was pretty cool. Being able to watch a live stream and seeing what was happening on the ground via some of these live blogs. I thought that was a pretty cool experience, and I really hope Apple continues to do this. There were no bugs. Everything was, their servers kept up, and everything was very smooth.
Yeah, I don't know why they don't always do it. There doesn't seem to be any method to the madness, but I do hope they continue it. But either way, they've been very good at releasing the video really quickly afterwards. So I prefer it live, but I always watch the video, and I did this time as well. I watched most of it live, and then I watched the whole thing again afterwards to kind of brush up on it and make notes for the show. But that is worth pointing out, because they haven't done that in a while. And then just this morning, I think the first people to notice was it was actually the Apple TV even got an update to be able to do it. And then you wondered, would they only do that as for Apple TV as some kind of promotion? But no, they, if you had any Mac or iOS device, you could live stream the video.
Yeah, that's right. So Schiller's on stage and he talks about the new Macs. And the one really important fact here is that the 13-inch MacBook Pro is the number one selling, I think it was the number one selling notebook, he said, for Apple. And yeah, it's a very popular laptop. And then what everyone was waiting for, he says, boom, introducing the new 13-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display. Goes over the new specs. And they show an ad, the new 13-inch MacBook Pro, the pricing starts at $1,699. Were you surprised at this announcement at all, or did you have a feeling that something was coming?
I wasn't surprised about the announcement because we had heard this rumor leading up to it. I was just surprised that they did the whole presentation again. It's kind of worth pointing out right now that Apple had five events this year. They had that iBooks author event, the iPad Retina event. They had their yearly WWDC keynote. Then they had the iPhone 5 launch and now the iPad mini. So they've had a lot of events this year. And when they introduced the 15-inch Retina at WWDC, they went into huge detail. And then you and I even messaged each other back and forth the other night. And I think you had said that you expected that this might even just be thrown in a press release. And I said to you, I think it'll be 30 seconds in one slide. And we were both way wrong. It was like there was a few moments like this, but this was the big deja vu moment, because I think if you played the two introductions back, he literally went through the whole dog and pony show again, except that it's a 13-inch. So I did find that a little strange, but I guess it is a product that is not only popular, people are really interested in it, they're really proud of it, and not everyone follows it like you and I do. So I guess it makes sense. But I was a little surprised that they went into so much detail, considering really there's nothing any different. It's a few $100 cheaper starting price and a smaller screen, but otherwise virtually identical to the 15-inch Retina.
Yeah, basically there's two options available. Basically, both can get, it comes with a 2.5 gigahertz processor, Intel dual core i5, 8 gigs of RAM, different options for flash storage, Intel HD graphics for 1,000, 7 hours of battery life, $1,699 and $1,999 were the prices. As for the resolution, 2560 by 1600 with a 227 pixels per inch. They said, you know, the new display has 75% reduced reflection. Basically all the updates of the 15-inch model, but into a 13-inch. Now, because they didn't announce this at WWDC and they had a pretty nice refresh to the MacBook Air, a lot of people decided to either buy the 15-inch MacBook Pro with Retina display or a MacBook Air, or I think they also had refreshed the 13-inch MacBook Pro as well. So it's so interesting how Apple is able to, you know, time their announcements, and it just so conveniently happens. It's right after we make a purchase, or, you know, we're thinking about doing one.
That I think is That's just a coincidence. The iPad and iPhone, it's a little different because there's more of a structure to that. But the MacBooks don't really have a regular schedule. They sort of update them when they decide. I think the writing was on the wall. Even when the 15-inch came out, you knew it was only a matter of time until they did a 13-inch. Like you, I know a bunch of people that just happened to be all kind of right needing a new laptop right around that time, and everybody sort of waited for WWDC to decide. I think right now what we're looking at here with this Retina display is you're looking at the future of Apple's laptops. Sometimes the future just is now. Like the MacBook Air just comes out and it's ready to rock. This time it seems like for pricing and various reasons they wanted to get the Retina out, but it can't replace the other models yet. So it's almost like getting a couple year preview of the future. Everybody I know, either online or personally, who has used one of these or owns one, says it's the best computer they've ever owned. Every review says it's great, but there's some minor growing pains with it. It's $300 or $400 or $500 more than an almost similar model without the Retina display. There's still the issue of not all apps being updated. There's still some minor complaints about how much pressure that display puts on the GPU, that you can sometimes have things being a little sluggish. So I think people who are designers or really into graphics, it's worth that extra money and those little pain points right now. But within a year or two, we won't even be discussing this. You're looking at the new MacBook. And in a year or two, this will drop several hundred dollars and the other one will just be phased out. So this is one of those times where Apple is sort of keeping both models, and it's a little awkward when you look at all the different SKUs. Apple's sort of known as having a really streamlined product line. There's starting to be a lot of different options, but I think they just decided this time that we had to get these things out now. The costs aren't going to come down until we're selling them and manufacturing them. The developers need time. It's a radical change to everything to be this high DPI. So I think that's what you're seeing.
Okay. I still think Apple is pretty smart with their release cycles, but obviously it really does depend on suppliers and how quickly they are able to put these into production too, right? Moving on, Apple did also announce a refresh to the Mac Mini. Basically, there are three options: $599 for 2.5 gigahertz dual core i5, 4 gigs of RAM, 500 gigabyte hard drive. For $799, you have a 2.3 gigahertz quad core Intel i5 with 4 gigs of RAM and a 1 terabyte hard drive. And for $999, you have, same as before, but a 2 terabyte hard drive. And this is a server model. It comes with Mountain Lion server. Basically, just a nice little refresh for those people who need a Mac Mini, which is a super small portable computer. And then moving on to the iMac, which I thought was pretty awesome. Apple introduced a refresh to the iMac lineup, the 21.5-inch and the 27-inch iMac. Basically, this is a completely redesigned machine that is incredibly thinner than compared to before. The edge of the display is only 5 millimeters thin. Apple is claiming it's 80% thinner than the previous generation. The laminated display is right up to the glass now, so there's 75% less reflection. Now there's FaceTime HD, dual microphones. Now there's also an option for what they're calling a fusion drive option, which is a hybrid solid state and regular hard drive combo. Basically just a radical new thinner design to the iMac, which I think a lot of us didn't see coming. I think there weren't any leaks of these new iMacs. When Apple did reveal an image or a slide or the actual iMac itself, and the crowd was like, whoa, and eyeing at how thin it really was.
Yeah, this is the closest thing we've had lately to a full surprise. There was rumors that they might refresh it. And I think about 3 or 4 days ago, there was a a Chinese supplier forum or something where somebody posted and said their uncle worked there and that there was going to be this radically thinner design, but there was no specs, no actual sizes, no leaked photos. So there was a little hint of this, but not a full-blown rumor. And as you said, the gas from the crowd, even just 5 millimeters, it's on the edges, it's thinner than your iPhone. And if you own or you've seen a current iMac, they're about an inch thick, and it's still bubbled in the back. So, I mean, it's far from a thick computer, but even at the inch they can't fit anything in, it's still bubbled right at the back. This design is 5 millimeters thin, and then that bubble in the back is so much thinner than it is even on the current version. It looks like something right out of the future, and I think this is a big, big redesign. I compare this to the iPhone 5. It's one of those things that if you look at it superficially, your quick first glance, it's like, oh, it's basically the same as before. It's still silver and black, and it's so it doesn't look radical in the sense they haven't, from, say, the Bondi blue to the white iMac, it's not radical from that standpoint, but like the iPhone 5, every single thing about it is redesigned. It's incredibly thinner. They went into great detail about all the stuff they're doing with the display being so much more less glare because it's thinner. The hands-on people today, I read several blogs today who said that even though this isn't, Apple's not calling it a Retina display, in some ways it almost is because they're using all the technology they figured out for the Retina display with that thinness and some of the pixel doubling and some of the settings. So I think this is the precursor to the Retina display. It's like, here's all the technology we need to make it a Retina display, and over the next couple of years we're going to bump that PPI up until we can call it a Retina display. And the thing that really jumped out at me that I think is really exciting is this Fusion Drive. Apple's not the first company to ship something that's a hybrid between a standard hard drive and a flash drive, but they now have built software right into the operating system where you can order this thing with like 128 gigs of flash storage and 3 gigs of regular hard drive storage, and it will smartly move your stuff around to make everything fastest. So they gave the example that if you use Aperture but not really iPhoto, they'll move all the iPhoto stuff onto the standard hard drive and keep Aperture on the flash drive. That's amazing to be able to do. I even know people who have both in their computer. Some people would mod their MacBooks and keep their operating system on a flash drive and then their storage, but you have to kind of manually manage that, and there's some drawbacks. This Fusion Drive looks to be the best of both worlds, so I can't wait to see how that actually works in practice and to see how all the benchmarks and everything go, but it does look like it's a great solution.
Yeah, the Mac Observer, I think they were at the event and they were able to get some more information from Apple about the new Fusion Drive. He said basically it's not necessarily a real caching concept, but basically, like you said, information that is used widely will be basically moved on to the solid state. And he also said that if in a solution like this, if one of the hard drives fail, both drives appear as one logical partition. So if one of your hard drive fails, it can be replaced with a third party drive and possibly be reconfigured as the Fusion Drive. I guess the next question is, how easy will it be to get into the new iMac? It looks pretty hard now to be able to customize the iMac. I think I read that I don't think you can do any RAM upgrades yourself this time.
This goes back to the same discussion we've had with the MacBook Air and then the Retina and now this. Apple is moving more and more to these thinner designs where you pretty much cannot upgrade anything yourself or even repair anything yourself. Again, the cynics can say that is just a money grab. I don't believe that. Apple doesn't have any track record of really doing that. They're in a better position than they've ever been financially. I just believe that they are trying to make these things as thin and light as possible. I've been using an iMac for years. it was never really easy to get in, but like you said, you could update the RAM yourself. But as far as the build quality, I've never had a Mac of any type go bad. I've always used it for as long as I've wanted it and then been able to either give it to a family member or sell it to someone that I didn't immediately hear from saying there was a problem. So if Apple continues to either keep their build quality right where it is and then combine that with really good support, like if you say have a, if your iMac comes with a year of AppleCare, you don't buy the extra coverage, and a year and 3 months later your Fusion drive craps out, Apple has a good track record of normally taking care of those people. If they continue with that, then I don't see this being a problem. If they ever release any type of hardware that starts to fail after several years that they weren't anticipating and people can't go in and basically do anything, then they're going to have a firestorm on their hands. But I have faith that they've continued to build these things really well. I hate having to pay the full price to upgrade the RAM. I've always just been able to buy RAM for $20 off Kijiji or from some deal at some mail away place. But that's one thing you're going to have to rethink when you're ordering from the Apple Store. Just bite the bullet, maximize the RAM if you plan to keep it for several years, because you're just, everything's moving towards this non-upgrade, non-serviceable designs.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. For example, I ordered a MacBook Air during the refresh at WWDC from this summer. And, you know, you have to make a choice. It's either you get the RAM now or you're not going to be able to upgrade it down the road. I think it comes as a trade-off. You know, do you want to be able to have a piece of hardware that is engineered to extreme thinness and in such a compact form factor where it's not easy or not possible to make room for a user to go in there and customize it yourself? Or do you want to stick to a machine that you can just upgrade forever? I mean, whatever floats your boat, but I mean, if you want that thinner design, you know, there has to be a trade-off.
Exactly. Nobody else makes a really thin model that you can go in and do much either. So it's, we've been seeing this for years. The laptop was always far less repairable and upgradable than other things. Even the old MacBooks, you could easily replace the RAM and hard drive, but everything else was going to be a major event to try to do. So I don't see this being a dramatic difference. It's a little kick to the people who like to get cheap RAM, say a few months later. That's the only negative. But in Apple's defense here a little bit, they've lowered the prices of RAM upgrades and they ship a lot more RAM with it. A lot of these models come with 8 gigs of RAM, and I don't think Apple ships anything without 4 gigs of RAM. And 4 gigs of RAM on Mountain Lion is actually plenty for the average user.
Right. So let's move on now back to the keynote. We're kind of drifting away here. Phil Schiller, after the iMac is introduced, Tim Cook comes back on stage and he is here to talk about the iPad. He says there's been 100 million iPads sold, which is incredible. This is an adoption rate that is actually faster than the iPhone. He does a recap of the education of iPads in education. He says there are now 2,500 classrooms using the iPad and iPad textbooks. Announces that there's going to be a new version of iBooks Author in the Mac App Store coming today. Then after that, he says Phil is coming back for the another iPad announcement. So Schiller comes back, and right away, he jumps into debuting the new fourth generation iPad, which is basically a refresh to the iPad 3 or the iPad third generation here. It now gets the same form factor, but we have an A6X chip, which is they're saying is double the CPU processor speed and graphics increase as well. There's now a FaceTime HD camera, a better worldwide LTE support, faster wireless networking, and the new Lightning connector that debuted with the iPhone 5. The capacities stay the same. The prices stay the same. Basically, there's a new iPad 4 or fourth generation iPad, and the former iPad 3 or the third generation iPad is dead. It's gone. It doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, where to start on this? This was a big surprise because although there were rumors that Apple was going to do a small refresh, everybody mentioned it being a refresh, and everybody pretty much said it was going to be, you know, it could be some internal stuff that they wouldn't even mention. Sometimes Apple does a small tweak on die shrinks and different things with how these chips work or their power output, and that there'd be a lightning connector. Phil Schiller comes out and calls it a fourth generation right away. So that was kind of shocking. And you almost didn't know right away if he meant, is this some kind of smaller iPad? Is this some different thing? Or was this whole event something different than we thought? So it was much more than just a simple refresh. This is truly the next generation of the 9.7 iPad that we know today. And like all Apple events, there's always the product. Like, of course, the iPhone 5 or whatever. That's what gets all the excitement. That's what gets people in line. That's what all the blogs are discussing. But I think this is secret, like, sort of underneath a big move for Apple because they've doubled the graphics. They've done the LTE, HD camera, lightning connector. It's a new iPad, but it's not an unbelievable difference. The body's the same, the weight and the thinness, all that's the same. So I'm wondering, what does this say? Why did Apple do this? Is this a simple time of year shift? Is this something that Apple was like, hey, we're not going to be able to, the Retina display is heavy, it costs a lot of money, we need a lot of battery. The technology has not improved in the last 6 or 7 months, and it's not going to improve in the next 3 or 4. So this is essentially what we would announce next April or May anyway, so we might as well get it out now because we'll take advantage of that Christmas season. So have we seen just a simple shift like we saw with the iPhone, that now the iPad is a fall product? Or are we seeing the iPad move into the Mac territory where it's like, we'll upgrade this whenever there's a reason to upgrade it, but that's why we named it the iPad. It's not the 3, it's not the 4, it's not the LTE, it's not the 5S. It's the iPad, it's the MacBook, it's the iMac, and it's always this great product. It's always going to run all the same stuff, and we'll do small tweaks when the time happens. That's, to me, that's what sticks out to me there is, I don't know which one of those two things is, but it's clearly one of those two, because this is it's more than a simple refresh, but it's not that take your breath away, the radical new iPad fourth generation.
Yeah, I think the issue here is the naming of the generations. I mean, I think that initially that sort of set an expectation that, you know, with a new generation, there should be some sort of, you know, a significant change, whether it's a cosmetic change or hardware. But, you know, first it went from the first iPad, and then went to the iPad 2, and then just to the new iPad or the third generation iPad. And now we have another update, which comes less than a year. So a lot of people who bought their third generation iPad back in, was it March or April? It was about 6 months ago. They're now feeling the heat that, hey, you know, I just bought my device, and now Apple comes out with a refresh, and, you know, what am I supposed to do?
Well, the keynote was only a few hours ago, and I've already heard what you just said numerous times, but we live in an echo chamber where we're on Twitter and we're in blogs, and we're hearing what other tech people are thinking. I'll be interested to see what the average consumer thinks. And I mentioned this last year on the podcast, that this was an area that I was concerned about and that I felt that Apple was concerned about, because it's one thing when you're releasing iPods and you can goof around with the colors and other little features to try to say, hey, come buy me again now, we've updated it. The iPad is more like a computer, so I think Apple wants to get to the point where it is just the iPad and you don't worry about the name. And maybe you're right that people are going to be feeling a little burned because it happened so quickly. But if you have a third generation iPad right now, you have to be a little nutty Like, I'm the king of upgrading. I upgrade every time. But why would you upgrade to this? It's significant if you're due for an upgrade. It's sort of like what they do with the phones. But there's nothing that jumps out at you. There's absolutely nothing that your current iPad doesn't do that this one does. Just like we saw this year with the iPhone, whereas the iPhone 5 doesn't do anything that the iPhone 4S doesn't do from a software standpoint. But yes, it's a big improvement tech-wise in the fit and finish and the feel of the phone. I think you're seeing the same thing with an iPad. I don't see anything. If they would have made the new fourth generation iPad half the weight, then that's something tangible. This, it's a nice upgrade, but I don't think people who just bought one are going to feel all that burned. But I guess we'll wait to see what the reaction is, because you're right. People are saying it and some people will think it, but my guess is that the average consumer isn't going to be really thinking that way.
Yeah, I think obviously there's going to be two camps. The person, the average Joe or Jane who just buys an iPad, they're not going to care about this upgrade. But for people who enjoy upgrading and buying, you know, the next Apple product, this does come a lot sooner than normal. I mean, it'd be interesting to see if the heat issue with the third generation iPad is gone in the fourth generation iPad. The new A6 processor, you know, I think it's custom designed. Apple might have made some sort of fixes in terms of battery management or whatnot, but my current iPad, the third generation, it doesn't get boiling hot, but it gets warmer than the iPad 2.
I still think that the heat issue is either related to heavy use of the GPU, or some people got like weird models, because I don't doubt you. Obviously yours does get hot, but mine is never even warm. Now, I don't do a ton, like I'm not playing that Asphalt whatever game all the time or any of those high intense graphic games, but I watch a heck of a lot of video on it, and I work on it sometimes for hours at a time, and mine, like my iPhone gets warmer than my iPad. And I've heard other people say that their iPad's cool all the time, and I've heard other people say it's hot all the time. So I still think there might have been, even in a manufacturing process, I wouldn't be shocked if you went to Apple and said, hey, my iPad gets too hot, I want a new one, and you might get a new one that isn't hot, because mine is literally never heated up. So I almost guarantee that's gone in this new one for sure, and I think it was only sporadic to begin with on the last one.
Yeah, it obviously does creep up in different scenarios. It depends on, you know, whether I'm not using the graphics processor, but I guess the fact is it's still getting warm. So, yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to follow up and see what other people are saying. But what was really interesting about the iPad fourth generation and the upcoming iPad mini that we're going to talk about, and all of these other Mac refreshes that came out today, it was that the prices in Canada for all of these products have now reached parity with our neighbors in the US for everything, except for accessories and the price of the unlocked iPhone 5. So if you go on apple.ca or apple.com, you'll see that the prices compared between the computers, the iPods, all of these Macs, they're all the exact same. Usually in Canada, we'd pay, you know, a premium compared to the US, whether it's like $50 more. But everything now is the exact same. I know that the Mac Pro is still $50 more in Canada compared to the States. But for those people who have been waiting for this day, it sounds like it's a pretty good time to buy Apple products.
Just quickly on that, has anything that wasn't announced today changed pricing?
What do you mean?
Like, so all these prices are the same now for all these new products they announced, but did they go back and change anything like the iPod Touches or any products that were around before, or did they just do this parity for everything announced today?
It was for everything announced today. Right. They actually, the iPad before, the base model price for a 16 gig Wi-Fi model was $519. in Canada. Yeah, that, now it's $4.99.
The reason I asked that is, I had a little method to that, is this is what Apple tends to do. As someone who's been buying Apple for years, being in Canada, Apple never really follows, it seems, the exchange rate that closely. There were times that it was $20 to $50 more, and our exchange rate would mean that big a difference, if not bigger, where Apple could even be eating a little bit. They just don't seem to change it that often. So my guess is they got around to make it coordinating it again, and our money's very close right now anyway, so it's perfect. But my guess is if the Canadian dollar took a huge dip or went way up or down in 3 months, Apple wouldn't jump to change those right away. So I think now was the time to price it again. They saw that the currencies were pretty much equal. I'm glad they did that, but I think that's part of the explanation. Apple just kind of decides at one point, and then they keep that for quite a while till they decide to do what they did today. They don't tend to fluctuate it a lot with the exchange rate.
Yeah, I guess the overall message is that, you know, a lot of the times people in Canada are just saying, you know, oh, you know, Canada gets screwed. We're always paying a premium on these products. And now we get to pay the same price. And so people before would drive down to the States to, you know, save like $50, but spend, you know, $30 on gas and, you know, $100 in groceries on the way back, and also pay, you know, taxes and all that stuff. And it works out to be the same. And so I guess, you know, it's just good to see, you know, the prices being the same on both websites, apple.ca and apple.com. Yes. I mean, before it's always a back and forth, like, oh my God, you know, how much more am I paying? Or, you know, for people who actually care, but
yeah. Our Canadian listeners know exactly what we're discussing, and everybody else doesn't really know. My only point was, it's awesome that it's cheaper now. Cheaper is always better, but Apple was always pretty good. It was never a ridiculous premium. And I found in general the last 4 or 5 years, when you look at, say, the price of a video game or the price of a CD, things like that, it's got a lot closer. 10 years ago, it was ridiculous. Like, if you looked at the cover price of a book, it would be like $9.99 US, like $19.99 Canadian. Like, things could be double, and our dollar was almost the same. So you're right, Canada, we've always got really messed around with the prices. And I know we have a few Australian listeners who are going through the roof right now saying, how dare you complain about $20 more? It's $100 more here. So we've never had it the worst, but we have been on the bad end of that before, and it's nice that it's cheaper now. So if you're out ready to buy an Apple product and you're in Canada, you're saving money, which is good.
Yeah, first world problems. Moving on. Here we have Phil Schiller come back on stage. He just told us about the new fourth generation iPad. And what I found was really interesting was the segue into the iPad mini. They basically had the fourth generation iPad on the screen on a slide, and there was an animation where it just did a 180-degree turn, and boom, right away, the iPad mini was pictured right on the screen. And Phil said to the audience, he says, I think you know what this is. And right away he got into it. This is the iPad mini. And he started going into the specs. Basically, it's a 7.9-inch display. The rumors are talking about 7.85 inches. I guess, you know, 7.9 is, you know, rounding up. Super thin aluminum chassis with an A5 dual core processor, front facing HD camera, 5-megapixel EyeSight camera on the back, new lightning dock connector, 10 hours of battery life, which is pretty good. Capacities are same as the other iPads, and there's also LTE as well. Two colors now. They say it's black and slate and white and silver, so those are the two colors. Pre-orders will begin on Friday, the 26th of October. And there's a really, really aggressive launch November 2nd, which is just a week after that Friday. And so many countries are involved, including Canada. When it came to the body of the device, Schiller says it's 7.2 millimeters thick and weighs 0.68 pounds, or about 308 grams. He compared it to be a quarter thinner than the fourth generation iPad, and it was, quote, you know, even thinner than a pencil. Basically, it also had similar construction to the iPhone 5 with those diamond cut edges, the chamfered edges that you see in the iPhone 5, which makes it a lot easier to hold in the hand. They compared it to a notepad as being as light as a notepad. You can now hold it in one hand. The display has the same resolution as the iPad 2, 1024 by 768. And because of this, all of the apps made for the non-Retina iPad, the iPad 2, also work in the iPad mini with no major involvement coming from developers. They don't need to really revise anything, significant changes, but all apps should work the same. The dual core A5 processor, it's basically similar to that of the iPad 2. We talked about that. There's no flash, of course. When it comes to battery, 10 hours. It also has a faster Wi-Fi, Bluetooth 4.0. Pricing, basically the same as before. The 16 gigabyte model starts at $329. Moving up to the 32 gig model, it's $429. And the 64 gig model is $529. This is for Wi-Fi. Moving on to the 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi plus cellular or LTE, depending on where you live, $459. 32 gig model is $559. The 64 gig model is $659. So huge, aggressive launch. Pre-orders start this Friday. And they also mentioned that the LTE model or the cellular option will be shipping a couple weeks after the Wi-Fi models. So the iPad lineup shows iPad mini, iPad 2, and the iPad with Retina display. That's what they're calling it now.
Yeah, a little strange that the iPad mini was the kind of the main event. And here we are. We've been discussing the event. We're almost 50 minutes into the podcast and we're just getting into it. Apple did the same thing. Usually they do a couple little things, introduce the main event, and then tack on a few things at the end. They seem to be refreshing their entire lineup. And then, oh, by the way, finally why you came here is this new iPad. We probably should have just skipped everything, or we should have stopped the show right now and done a whole other show on this, because this is a big, big announcement. And again, there's some kind of hidden things that kind of show where Apple's headed moving forward. We have been hearing about a 7-inch or a smaller iPad basically almost since the other one came out. If you remember, Steve Jobs, very shortly after the initial launch, was on that conference call and people were asking about a smaller iPad, and he said what he said that we all know, kind of dismissed it. And all these rumors leading up, literally for years since the iPad came out, but really heated up the last several months, you basically were hearing two conflicting rumors. There was the rumor that this was still going to be a premium product and have premium specs and was going to stick to Apple's traditional big markup. So it'd be slightly cheaper than an iPad, but it was still going to be sort of premium pricing. And then you heard the idea that it was basically going to be an iPad 2 and start at $249. There was even some rumors that it could go down as low as $199 with an 8 gig model. They didn't do that at all. The specs are between an iPad 2 and a fourth generation. It has a better camera. It has a better FaceTime camera than the iPad 2. It has LTE. It has the dual band Wi-Fi. So it has the Lightning connector. There's a lot of areas where it's an improvement. Go ahead.
Yeah. One huge advantage of the iPad mini is that it comes with Siri, whereas the iPad 2 does not. The iPad mini will also use a new nano SIM for the cellular models. The nano SIM is obviously the new standard that we first saw in the iPhone 5. I think with the iPad mini here, we need to really get hands on and take a look at that finish of the iPad and compare it to the iPad 2, which is relatively old now, if you want to talk about In terms of technology and technology timelines. As for the pricing, I think the $329 pricing surprised a lot of us. That is because initial rumors stated that, this tablet would be either priced at $200 or $250 and blow away, the Google Nexus 7 or, the Kindle Fire HD and tablets like that of, the 7-inch nature. But from hearing what people have said online, we know that Apple doesn't like to play the pricing war game with its competitors. They always have their prices, a bit higher than usual because you are paying for a better product. By pricing it at $329, this will basically force its competitors to be cheaper than Apple and stay within that $200 to $250 range. And those competitors have stated that at that price, they're not making money on those tablets. They're basically breaking even, and they're hoping that they'll make money when users buy apps or books or content. So for Apple, they're still making money on the hardware, but they're also going to make money on apps and any other content you buy from iTunes as well.
Yeah, you mentioned that people were surprised about the price. I think some people were surprised, and some people like me were not surprised at all. I would have been surprised the other way. My contention this whole time, even back to previous episodes, we've discussed it, is I was always highly skeptical of the Apple releasing a cheaper, smaller iPad to compete with the Nexus 7 and the Kindle and these other apps. It just didn't sound like Apple to me, so I wasn't surprised. And I think what you saw here, a couple things, just to finish my point from before, is this isn't just a smaller iPad 2, which was the rumor. There's significant areas where it's better. It's not spec for spec with the new $500 fourth generation, but it's certainly an improvement on the iPad 2. It also has a new design, which borrows some elements from the iPhone 5, which I think is interesting. And the thinness and lightness is one of those things, much like the iPhone 5. The people who have had their hands on it say it feels even lighter than an iPhone 5, just based on the form factor. It's incredible the way it feels. I think what you're seeing here is Apple, despite the rumors, isn't playing the price game. They were not feeling the pressure, because talk all you want about those prices, the Android, including the Nexus 7 and the the Amazon Fire HD or whatever those are doing fairly well at that price, but they're not selling like crazy. We see it in the app numbers. We see it in the website hits. We see it by people like Marco Arment talking about how many copies of Instapaper selling. Those tablets are not selling in large numbers. So I mean, Apple isn't.
Yeah. Apple has, to this date, they have still refused to release any numbers about Kindle Fire sales or even Kindle sales. All they say is the Kindle Fire is one of the best-selling products on Amazon.com, which everything is a bestseller on Amazon.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. The other one little thing I want to say about the keynote, and this is where Apple has to market it. I don't think the average consumer watches these keynotes. So this, what makes the iPad better, and he was very specific about this, is even though it's less than an inch diagonal, it's like an Android or a Kindle, they're 7-inch diagonal. This is 7.9, but the Kindle is 16:9 ratio. This is still that 4:3. So he went into great detail to show that even though it's only less than an inch on the diagonal, it's actually 30% more screen real estate overall. And that makes a huge difference. And he even went in and showed like four or five different apps, because I've played with these other devices. Apple's being extra crude and really bringing attention to it, but it truly is. They are running blown up iPhone apps. There's nothing wrong with iPhone apps, but because of that size, they're single column. So you scroll down to get more information. On the iPad, you see these 2 and 3 column layouts, which are sometimes better for certain type of software. So they really were trying to, and they even called it, the tagline was every inch an iPad. He was trying to make the point that this is the smaller, lighter iPad, but the software you're getting is iPad software, not blown up iPhone software. So I think that only 1 inch bigger is deceiving when you're comparing 16-9 versus the 4-3 ratio you're actually getting. He also mentioned that I think the 7-inch has a total square inch of 21.9 and the iPad mini has like 29.9. So it's significantly more screen real estate despite what seems like very similar diagonal number.
Yeah, I guess he's trying to give a real world example of why the iPad mini would be a better product compared to, you know, something from Amazon or Google. I think it's interesting because Google is set to announce its own sort of media event coming up, and people think they're going to announce a refresh to the Nexus 7 lineup. And this Friday is the launch of the Microsoft Surface and Windows 8. And today, just the worst timing of all, but I think the embargo was released on these Microsoft Surface reviews, and they've just been absolutely smothered by all of these Apple announcements today, whether it's, you know, the new iMac, the 13-inch Retina display, MacBook Pro, the iPad Mini, iPad 4th generation, now the iPad Mini. I mean, it's pretty hard right now for Apple's competitors to even get a headline because there's just so much out there to talk about right now. So I think, you know, the announcement of the iPad Mini now is also seemed like it was strategically placed to basically dominate the fall headlines.
Yep. And I don't think today anything changed. Over the next couple of years, we're going to see this whole thing shake out. But we know for a fact that traditional Apple users, they're locked into iPad. They have zero interest in Android or Microsoft or any of these other tablets. That's just a fact. If half of a percent of typical Apple users switch, that would be an incredible number. I don't even believe. Apple people aren't going to switch. Microsoft users have shown over the last several years that they're getting fed up with a lot of the Windows stuff, so they're moving over to iPad. I'm surprised at the number of people I hear, even in the tech community and just everyday people, who have some type of Android phone and they're really happy with it, but still have an iPad. So Google hasn't even been able to convince some of their biggest fans to necessarily move over, and I don't think any of this changes right now. So I think for at least the next couple years, Apple's in the dominant position. I think they made absolutely the right move here today. I do not think they needed to go down. Yes, they're going to lose when someone comes in and they're buying their kid something, or they don't care about tech at all and they're just looking for something to play a few movies and read a few books. They may be leaving that money on the table by not having a $199 or $249 model, but this product is a good value at $329. And out of all the rumors, I just wanted to point out that I thought it was interesting that I think John Gruber actually was dead on here. Gruber, if you're a Daring Fireball reader, for the last several months he was calling it an iPad Air. And he kept saying, I don't know for a fact they'll call it an iPad Air, but it's the iPad Air concept. And when you think about what he was saying, and just even yourself, that's exactly what this iPad is. If you look at a MacBook Pro or a MacBook Retina, they're the premium product when you're talking about video card, graphics, RAM, and all those things. But the MacBook Air has very quietly become almost as good spec-wise, but in this thinner, lighter, cheaper form factor that can almost compete with the specs. Now you're seeing the exact same thing with the iPad. It's thinner, lighter, cheaper, and almost, again, can almost compete with the iPad spec-wise. So I think his analysis there was dead on. You're basically, they called it the iPad Mini, but what you're looking there is an iPad Air. It's not a cheap Kindle Fire competitor. It's the cheaper, lighter iPad.
Yeah, and he also predicted that Apple would not release it with a Retina display, partially for two reasons. One being that most first-generation launches of Apple devices, they tend to be non-Retina first, and eventually they do get Retina in the next generation. Secondly, he also put into question concerns over battery and processing power to power a Retina display on a smaller iPad. So once again, you know, after the dust had settled, the iPad mini does not have a Retina display, but from the early hands-on reviews from other media outlets that have been there, they're saying that it still looks very good because of the because it's a smaller iPad. The resolution is still like the iPad 2, but there's more pixels crammed in there. Basically, it resembles the screen of an iPhone 3GS, basically.
Yeah, it's sort of like the iMac situation. It's not a Retina display, but Apple's continued to improve their Retina, I mean their non-Retina displays in other ways. The thinness, the closeness to the glass, the fact that it is smaller form factor means I think it's actually around 163 or 169 PPI, which isn't the 200 and whatever we expect for the Retina, to call it a Retina, but that's still higher than, much higher than we used to see on other similar devices or even computers just a few years ago. So everybody mentions that it's still a great looking screen. You hear a lot of people, again, I don't always want to sound like the Apple defender, but you always hear these little ideas around these launches saying, well, they didn't put a Retina display in because they got to save something for next year. Well, no, they don't. They can come up with other things. It just comes down to trade-offs. You can't just have everything and get to a certain price, or you can't have everything and get to a certain thinness. It's all about trade-offs. And as we've seen with the iPad, even the fourth generation, 6 and 7 months later, they have not been able to deal with the weight issue. The amount of battery to try to get, like Apple's trying to run an impossible game here. They're trying to maximize battery life. They don't want to dip below that 10-hour battery life that they're so well known for, but they want it to be thin. And the Retina display needs so much power that the iPad 4th generation and 3rd generation are fairly heavy in comparison. So that's that trade-off. So to me, it has nothing to do with price or saving something for next year. It's they to make it that small and thin and light, you had to keep the battery smaller so it wasn't going to run that. When the battery, either one of two things are going to happen in the next year or so. Either battery technology is going to improve, which is unlikely because it hasn't in years, or they're going to be able to power the Retina every year with a little less power, and then you'll see a Retina in everything, and it'll be a non-issue. Everything will last 10 hours and have Retina. But right now, that's the trade-off they made, and that's why, again, I like the comparison of it being an iPad Air. I think that's a really apt comparison.
Yeah, I mean, I think Retina is something that, for those that have experienced Retina displays either on their iPhone 4 at first, and then the iPad third generation, going from Retina to non-Retina is probably one of the most painful situations ever, and is classified as a first world problem. It's,
yes.
Everything just looked horrible. For that reason alone, I remember seeing one of my friends, he picked up the 15-inch Retina display MacBook Pro. I unfortunately went and, you know, saw his computer and saw how amazing that screen was. And now when I look at my MacBook Air, I want to just put this thing in a blender. It's just not fair. But we're not there yet with the MacBook Air and it getting a Retina display. Let's finish up on the overall wrap up of this keynote here. I think it was quite aggressive by Apple to announce so many products so late in the year, but it's pretty incredible that they've been able to do this. It's very impressive, and it looks like they are going guns blazing into this holiday quarter. I mean, I cannot wait to see what the sales will show. I mean, as much as people are downplaying the iPad mini, a lot of people downplay the iPhone 5, and we know what happened there.
Oh, this thing is going to sell like crazy. My final thoughts on the keynote is just that back in March or whenever it is, you and I recorded an episode for the iPad Retina keynote, and we both remarked that we thought it was really interesting that Tim Cook at the end of the presentation said, we have a big year planned. Steve Jobs was famous for his keynotes but he usually let that day's product stand. He usually, you mean, he'd say something generic like, hey, we look forward to getting back to work and bringing you more great stuff. But Tim Cook sort of laid down the gauntlet and was like, 2012 is going to be a big year. You'll see us some more. We've got some more great things. And some people wondered, does that mean a TV? Does that mean some radical new product? We didn't see that, but we saw them update both operating systems and all their hardware, minus the poor Mac Pro. And that's a pretty aggressive year for Apple. So that's what I'll leave it on, that he promised a big year. It was a big year. They refreshed everything. They did 5 events this year, which there's other years they've only done 2. This was certainly a big, big year for Apple. And I think next year there's no reason to think it won't be the same, but they were certainly aggressive. If you think about just even the manpower, if you remember, if you've been in the Apple game long enough, you'll remember quite famously they delayed Leopard because they had to get iOS done for the iPhone. And now you have obviously bigger teams and a company firing on all cylinders when they can upgrade every single hardware product and both of their major operating systems all in one calendar year. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and one last thing about the keynote is it was handled only by 2 people. Tim Cook and Senior Vice President Phil Schiller. And this was at a smaller venue that just had over 1,000 seats, and they were able to accomplish this. So,
And there's already some conspiracy theories going around that Scott Forstall's in the doghouse because of Maps, and I don't buy that. There was no software announced today, so it wouldn't even have made sense to have him out there. So it was just Tim and Schiller today, but I don't read anything into that. There was no software announced today.
Yeah, normally there are demos of, you know, how a game would look on, you know, the new device. But today they stuck to the schedule. It was very carefully orchestrated on time. Just guns blazing. Here's what's new. Here are the prices. Here's when you can buy it. See you later. Get your wallets ready. I want to buy everything.
I guess we have to discuss one more thing about this keynote before we wrap it up. The bottom line every time, are you buying one?
Am I buying one? Yes, I am. I'm going to buy an iPad mini.
And are you buying one just because you blog and discuss Apple, or are you genuinely interested? Like, if you could somehow put in your mind that you don't run a blog about Apple and you don't do this podcast, would you still want to buy one?
I would. If I wasn't running the site and if I wasn't doing the podcast, I would probably want to go hands on and get a feel for it first. But because I am running the site and I am doing the podcast, I am genuinely curious to get my hands on this right away, and I don't want to wait.
Yeah. So I was going to say the same thing. So I will definitely be buying one, mostly to discuss it on the podcast and blog about it. And I also do a lot of design work, so I want to be able to test designs on it. But from a long-term standpoint, I'm interested to see how I'll feel about it, because I actually told you a couple nights ago, my big master plan was to buy the new iPad mini, sell my third generation iPad Retina, which I figured would have premium value because it would still be the number one product at the time. And then I would wait until March when the new iPad came out and decide, do I like the smaller format or the bigger? And Apple just blew that out of the water now, because now there's a new full screen one. I mean, the full size one now. So I'm very torn because I like the bigger size. If anything, I almost would like a 13-inch iPad. I like the screen real estate, but I'm seduced by this really thin and light thing too. So I guess what I'll probably do is just buy one. But here's the other thing, no matter how nutty Apple fans are, I don't see any need to have both. Like, you got to be pretty, money laying around think you need both.
I'm not going to be sitting there using both. The iPad mini is going to be for my wife, so because I primarily use the iPad third generation. I'm basically going to, you know, get her the iPad mini. That's my story anyways. but what I actually want to do is I want to compare the third generation iPad and have the iPad mini side by side, because like you said, really, do you need two of these in a household? I mean, I find the iPad third generation is awesome for movies. It's awesome for browsing the web, but I do find it a bit heavy. I'm going to admit that. I do find it heavy for one-handed operation. But at the same time, dealing with smaller 7-inch tablets before, I find that they can be awkward because you can't really hold it far away and you can't really put it very close up. It's kind of a sort of a mid, it's kind of at a weird distance from your eyes because you need to find that optimum viewing distance. So there's also that reason. So, I really do love the iPad 3. I think I'm going to keep it anyways because of the Retina display. Once you see that Retina display, it's just like, wow, text is just incredible. As for reading, as for owning a device solely for reading, I actually ordered an Amazon Kindle Paperwhite, which is going to be shipping later in November. I previously had another Kindle just for reading. Some people are probably wondering why. And that's because, I find reading on e-ink is a lot more relaxing at the end of the day, as opposed to moving from your computer's LCD screen to another LCD screen. I find it just adds to further eye strain. So,
yeah, I've never had a Kindle.
That's my setup.
Yeah, I've never had a Kindle just because I actually find, especially with the Retina on the iPad, it doesn't really bother my eyes. And I tend to read on my iPad for short bursts 5 or 6 times throughout the day, as opposed to just, say, going to bed and like laying in bed and reading for an hour, like a novel or something. So I think it all depends on who the person is. What you were saying about, this is an example of Apple willing to cannibalize themselves. They realistically know that almost nobody needs both of these devices. I think it just comes down to how you use your iPad. I think if you tend to use your iPad for video, for productivity things like OmniFocus, and you tend to use it at home, you're going to prefer the main iPad. If you do a lot of reading, so you're holding it for long periods of time, you do a lot of in and out, bringing it back and forth to the office, the thinner and lighter might be easier to carry. So I think you'd have to be really have a lot of money laying around extra to feel like, oh, I want the smaller one to carry around, but then I just want the other one. I don't think the size difference is so dramatic. Any apps that you like, I love OmniFocus and some of my calendar apps on the iPad. I do a lot of my planning that way on the iPad. I like that extra real estate, but if I only had the smaller one, I don't think that little bit smaller is going to make that big a difference. So I look forward to getting it, putting it through its paces for several months, and then it will be interesting long term what I decide to keep or keep buying in the future. And I think that will be a decision a lot of people will have to face, but I wouldn't be surprised if very shortly after it's launched that the iPad mini becomes the best selling one, not just because of the price, but the what most people are doing with it.
Yeah, so pre-order is this Friday. Pretty sure it's going to sell out. There's so many countries that are part of this pre-order on the launch day there. It's quite aggressive, like I said. If you want to get one, then you better jump on it quick this upcoming Friday. So
yep. Same advice as always. If you want one on day one, pre-order or line up that first day, because you can almost always get one by going to the store the first day, but those several weeks after, it's a crapshoot and you usually can't get one.
Okay, so this was our recap, episode 53. This was the Apple special event, October 23rd, 2012. Do we have time for app picks, or we're going to save that?
We'll do a couple really quick just because we've literally promised 2 or 3 weeks in a row to get to them, and the shows are going so long, we're skipping over. So I'll do a few quickly, and then if you have something, you can do it. First one, this is one I could go on for an hour, but I'll really make it quick. There's an app called Jasmine, Jasmine. It's a YouTube app. It follows my theme of last week of that these one-man developer shops, similar to Sparrow, can kick Google's butt. The YouTube app stinks on the iPhone. They don't even have it updated for the iPhone 5 screen. This single developer shop was somehow able to do it. Google couldn't. everything about it is faster. Everything about it is fewer clicks away. It's just a much more intuitive app, really clean design, and it's free. So there's no reason not to try it. So Apple no longer has YouTube themselves. Google has released another one of their web app, half-assed web view apps. Here's a native YouTube app that's fantastic. And I'll add one other little point of another example where Google's don't be evil and all their stuff is just complete bullshit. The developer has been contacted by Google and he has to remove the ability to play audio in the background, which was a great feature of Apple's app, was a great feature of this app, and Google doesn't do it because their partners don't want it. So even though it could be easily considered fair use, I won't get into a whole rant about it, but this is just another example of Google getting rid of a perfectly good feature that they would have fought for before, but now they just roll over for these partners because they're trying to sell music in their Play Store. So that's, check out Jasmine. It's a really cool app. Knowing Google, they'll buy it or shut it down or whatever else, but another example of a one-man developer shop kicking Google's butt when it comes to making apps. And then the other big news, the big newsworthy app this week was a thing called Circa News, C-I-R-C-A. It's similar to a Flipboard, but they're trying to approach it completely different. Instead of, say, the iPhone keynote being an article from The Verge or from iPhone in Canada, they actually have writers who go and summarize like 5 or 10 different articles, and then they have the links to where their sources are. So it's they're saying it's their whole other attempt at journalism, and it's a really slick app, really fast, really easy to flip through. And I find that it's nice not to have to subscribe to channels. You don't have to do anything. You just launch the app, and in about 5 minutes on your iPhone, you get a really good view of the world. They'll cover the big tech stories. They'll cover the U.S. election. They'll cover events going on around the world. So to me, it's the best way to just sort of, in five minutes, know what's going on in the world.
Yeah, I've actually been playing around with Circa. Initially, when it was first launched, I tried to download it in Canada, and I guess it was still propagating, and it didn't hit the Canadian App Store yet, so I thought it wasn't available here. But I guess, you know, later on in the day or day later, it was available. And like you said, it's a pretty awesome app because it has the most concise summaries of stories, and they're very factual. So it's a really easy way to digest information on any sort of current event that's going on.
Yeah, it takes the best of what we found from things like Flipboard from a design standpoint, but takes a whole new approach to journalism. Now, I'll be interested to see how something like this is sustainable cost-wise and everything, but I just appreciate somebody doing a different approach. And as you said, it's very fact-based. So when they're covering, say, the election, it's actually nice to read an article about the presidential debate and actually just get a list of, here's the 5 areas Romney lied about, and here's the 5 things Obama lied about. You're not dealing with whoever's slant, where they make one guy out to be a complete liar and the other guy to be totally truthful. They're just, these are the different things they brought up. Here's where we found these different fact-checking organizations, and it's all laid on the table. There's, you mean, nothing's probably completely neutral, but it's a very quick and fact-based thing to check up on the news, and I really like it so far.
Yeah, and another thing is, I think the interface is friggin' awesome. It's just, you know, one flick up and boom, you have a small little curated short paragraph about, you know, little tidbits, and also links to, you know, primary sources or other links to sources on the story. So it is pretty awesome. I just hope that, you know, they can continue. And I did notice that sometimes the stories aren't updated as often as they should be, but I guess that's because I was about to say that
the one feature that I thought was a little bit lacking, but just suddenly worked today. And I don't know why this, if they're having trouble or just the way I set it up, but they have this neat feature that you can follow a story. And when you follow the story, then you get updates. So I guess the only story, maybe it's my fault, the only story I apparently would hit the plus button to follow was the iPad mini story. So all of a sudden today during the keynote, I'm getting like 5 push notifications from this app saying, well, we just updated this, we've just updated this. And before that, I hadn't got a single update. So I guess maybe it either just started working today, or because I only chose that story and the other stories they didn't update. But if they continue to update, that's a neat feature where you can say, hey, I want to stay informed about this story, and then you get updates as they add more facts to it.
Okay. I'm going to recommend one app for those looking to try out Passbook. If you haven't tried out Passbook yet, it's pretty neat. If you like Starbucks, you're probably already using the Starbucks app. It's been updated in Canada as well to support Passbook, and in the UK and the US. If you don't like Starbucks, you can also try out Passbook with the Cineflex mobile app or any other app, but it does work very well with the Starbucks app. After you add your Starbucks card in your account, within the app, you just add it to Passbook, and you know, when you show up to a location, Starbucks appears on your lock screen. You just slide your finger and boom, your barcode of your Starbucks card is right there and you can pay right away. So it's really Passbook. Easy, and it's, I think that's the next biggest thing that's coming right now.
Yeah, if everybody starts supporting Passbook and are clever how they do it, it's really a cool feature. And because we're so short on time, I'll give the perfect final pick, because it's like 30 or 40 picks in one. For Mac users, we are at the time of year that Mac Heist is going on right now. If you're not familiar with Mac Heist, they have every couple years a big bundle. They've turned it into a whole big event. They have games and movies, and it's a whole almost culture over there. But the bottom line is they get together 10 or 20 really good Mac apps, and they sell a bundle. It's normally $50. This year, it's only $30. The main bundle is $29, and you can even get about a $5 discount off of that by playing some of their games. In the bundle, right off the top of my head, Scrivener is the best writing app they make for a Mac. So if you need a combination of a word processor and like storyboarding and cork boards and kind of planning a project, most professional writers who are on a Mac use Scrivener. I heard about it for years and years and years before I tried it, and then I tried it, and it's fantastic. So with no hesitation, the best writing app there is. So that alone is probably worth the $29. There's also an app called Artboard, which is similar to CorelDRAW. It's a graphics app that's very good that I've used. And it also comes with an app called Printopia, which basically turns any printer into an air printer, but even has other cool features where you can be on your iPhone and you come across a web page that you want to print. You can hit print, and instead of just connecting with any printer you have set up, it gives you all these other options like print this to a PDF and send it to Dropbox, or open it right now on my Mac on preview. Printopia is a fantastic app that I've recommended on the show before. It's normally $20 on its own. You can get it as part of this bundle for $29. And to make it even better, today Mac Heist created a second bundle of 15 free apps that all you have to do is either post the link on your Facebook or your Twitter. They'll give you all 15 of the apps for free. And there's some good apps in there. There's one called Gemini, which finds duplicates on your Mac. It's great. There's one called Sound Converter, which I've literally tried every sound converter out there because I have some weird old audio files that I could never convert. This is the one app that could convert everything. If you have old weird Windows media files or anything, it'll convert anything into anything. And it has an app called Faves, which takes all your favorites from Facebook, Twitter, Instapaper. We always complain that there's so many social networks. It combines all of your favorites into one interface, and it really works nice. And again, I think that app's normally $5 or $10, which I would recommend at that price, but you can get it free today by going to Mac Heist. I'll put all the links in the show notes, but there's no reason not to at least get the free bundle and consider that $29.99 bundle, because it's got some great stuff.
Yeah, every year I look at Mac Heist and I think to myself, do I really need these apps? So I think how I decide is it if I do see one app that I've been waiting to buy and it appears in the bundle, I'll just get it because it's so worth it. But if you don't see anything in there, just wait until next year because the bundles are usually pretty awesome.
I would only give this advice. If you don't see anything you want, you probably should pass on it. But my experience with Mac Heist every year is there's one or two apps I'm really interested in. I decide, the price of the bundle alone makes those two apps worth it. And then I find a year later, I discovered two or three more apps I like. You inevitably, because you have them, you install them all and you try to use them, and five or six or seven of them you'll never look at again. But I find that every year there's one or two that I did not anticipate using, and it becomes like one of my favorite apps. So if there's something you're interested in, and there's the added bonus that there's money going to charity and you're supporting Mac independent developers, so it's a good thing all the way around if there's something you're even remotely interested in. And if you're not, just grab the free one today, because there's some good stuff there.
Okay, I think that pretty much does it for episode 53 of the iPhone Podcast. Once again, thanks for listening to the iPhone Podcast. Please do us a huge favor and rate us in iTunes. There were a couple reviews in the Canadian store, which thank you so much. If you think we're doing a great job, we'd love to hear it. If you hate us or you think we suck, we'd love to hear that too. Your feedback is great. You can follow the show and provide feedback by visiting theiphonepodcast.com or by following us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/iPhoneInCanada and twitter.com/JustinLouis. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.